to Damarati, our then chair, that was in 1989, who took a real interest and encouraged me in meditation. And I was somebody who came on that evening, and I didn't have, there were many sub-35 group people here, but I really understand that desire to be among a younger group, because when I came at 25, 24, something like that, I looked around, I really didn't want to sit on a cushion for an hour. That just was not my idea of an interesting sort of activity. But obviously something went in, it planted a seed, and the way that Damarati and others explored the nature of meditation, it opened that up as an adventure, as an exploration. Thank you also to Maitreya Bandhu, whose courses gave me a more sustained way towards Dharma practice, to Ratnagosha, another of our former chair people, whose presence was one of the main reasons that I moved from where I was living with my then partner to a room upstairs, actually almost exactly above my head now. And to try once again in community life. I tried living in a community in Oxford for about a year. That community folded, I hope not due to my arrival, again I thought there were things to still to explore there, so I felt very grateful to be living in Sukhavati community, where I stayed about 6 years, I think. To Pramavajra, who Jnanavacha has mentioned quite fully, his friendship, so freely and openly given. In a way, I could think about my passage through the ordination process as the story of that friendship. I mean, it's my good fortune that friendship has continued and continues now, but certainly my understanding of what might mean to try to practice the precepts more deeply, to try and understand what it implied to take on those words increasingly as vows. that was an incredibly enjoyable as well as challenging process, and much of that was due to, or a goodly part was due to, the naturalness of that unfolding in a lived relationship. In the tradition, there's much discussion of the guru-chela relationship, the guru and the disciple, and that's something which in the culture more broadly in the West that we're can be quite sceptical of and not know quite how to relate to a more mature figure quite in that way. But I found that very easy with Pramavajra. So my thanks also to Suvajra, who led study on the White Lotus Sutra during a sabbatical year that I had in Pune in 1995, when I was thinking about asking to become a Mitra. In fact, I had a meeting with Deva Mitra in the Mahavihara in Pune, I don't know if you remember, and saying that I'd like to become a Mitra. I'd moved myself to Delhi to study painting, and I accidentally became a contributing editor to the Indian magazine, so I was doing a lot of writing. But I was very keen to explore my own commitment more deeply, and David Mitchell very kindly met up with me and said, well, you know, as long as you've got no expectations, because you're an outlying Mitchell, or a very outlying Mitchell in that case, we had no activities in Delhi at that time, he said, as long as you know you're happy with that, then absolutely we'll take you on. And so I had my Mitchell ceremony at the Bhaja Center, retreat center in India, so my thanks for that. And I'm also grateful this evening to be given a space at the Monday class to do this. I come to the Monday class and its equivalent over the years whenever I can, and it's an important part of my Dharma training. And I'm grateful to the team for allowing me the space, and to you for being here to listen to what I have to say. It's not possible to communicate the Dharma without people who aspire to communicate something of the truths that hopefully they've glimpsed, even partially, and people who are interested in receiving that communication. I'm grateful to my well-functioning chapter, where I've been for 12 years since my ordination, and as chapter convener for 9 of these. And I was very grateful to be the chapter convener. It was a way that I could serve, and serve the myth of the order, if you like. A chapter convener doesn't have a specific role or job. In fact, it's very important that that role isn't thought of in quite that way. And that gets us into mythic territory, which is not the focus of this evening. But that chapter has been a steady focus for me since ordination, particularly for confession practice, for exploring the precepts and how we relate to them in our diverse lives. I'm grateful to Bhante, to our teacher, Sangharachita, whose journey and the creative acts of translation that he's made have made these Buddhist teachings so much more readily available, so much more intelligible, accessible, put into a language that's more comprehensible to us here in the West. When Bhante sought his own ordination shortly after the end of the Second World War, he really had to seek to find these teachings, and then through his own practice, his understanding of the cultures both in India and in Britain, to become this bridge. He's written lots of books, as you probably know, over 60, I think, and in Moving Against the Stream, The Birth of a New Buddhist Movement, he writes the following in relation to his search. We walked out to Saranath, where the Buddha had first taught the Dharma, and where we hoped to be ordained. We were disappointed. The Sinhalese monks of the Mahabodhi Society wanted nothing to do with these two barefoot, penniless strangers. We therefore decided to walk to Kushinagar, where the Buddha had died, and seek ordination there. It was the worst time of year to do so. The hot wind was blowing, the temperature was 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Any of you who've travelled in India in the dry season, you might have a sense of what that's like. People were dropping dead from the heat, but there was no alternative. Doing as much of our walking as we could in the early morning, and at night staying at temples and ashrams, we covered the distance in 10 days. I don't know how many of you have been on pilgrimage. Saranath is one of the traditional pilgrimage sites. It is a long way from Saranath to Kushinagar. On pilgrimage with my private preceptor, we visited Kushinagar and the room where Bhante's first ordination took place. He had several ordinations into different strains of the tradition, and this was his first. And that room is still preserved as it was. I want to mention that because I don't think many of us visit that place, and it is well worth seeing. So that's sort of glimpse of Bhante's journey. And by contrast, it's always struck me very strongly, because I've in my life have been on the road a lot and I enjoy travelling, but it strikes me, you know, how easy it is for us to get the tube on the Central Line, a few stops to Bethnal Green, and drop in for a class. Our challenges are not those of our teacher in having to strive and seek to find the Dharma, to walk all of those miles in 120 degrees heat. Our challenges are perhaps the older ones for any practicing Buddhist: how to purify our minds and our hearts. We have this juxtaposition. We can get closer to Buddha figures, even have many Buddhist texts on our shelves, even have a preceptor and a Buddhist name, even perhaps live in a Buddhist community, help or work at a Buddhist centre, have a Buddhist partner. All of these things are good. Some are very good, wonderful even. But how does that affect our conduct in this moment, our daily activity of aspiring to become more aware of our mental states, protecting the positive states and transforming the negative states? Do we have an acquisitive attitude to Dharma practice, wanting to develop the comforts that we have in the delights of city life, and just tack on some Buddhism to make us a bit happier? Can certainly recognise this observation in my own practice at different times. So back to gratitude. So gratitude is good. It's good to give and it's good to receive. It's an antidote for a culture and a time when scepticism and even cynicism, among others' motives, are more often seen as a mark of the true story of what's happening, or even as a mark of intelligence, or even of being cool. I say the true story advisedly because the way that we talk about each other, the public conversation, and Janowicz has mentioned a lot of my working life has been in documentary film and as a reporter in radio and other media. And so this has been on my mind a lot. What counts as news is unlikely to be expressions of gratitude. So if we want a public discourse shot through or marked by positive mental states and in line with Dharmic teaching, it's up to us to create it, to grow this new culture, a task which has become very much easier with the quick dawn of social media. We have so very much to be grateful for. I've said this, and I started with this, but it's an assertion. Is it true? Is it true? Do we really have things to be grateful for? Is it more common that we don't notice what we could be grateful for, still less express gratitude? So this contention that we have much to be grateful for, I want to invite us to test this out a bit and even try to anchor this or make it a little more clear. Ideally, to make it viscerally clear by examining our own experience this evening. Visceral is well, you probably know this, but visceral is about an experience which is deeply related to a felt emotion. It's not just an intellectual idea. And this division between thought and emotion, I find it very useful to return to that, because that division has a very particular history in this corner of the world. It's related, for example, to French philosophy, to the way that Descartes has been taken up in a division of head and heart. The Buddhist tradition and its roots in ancient Indian culture does not observe this distinction. So traditional Buddhist language would talk more about, for example, the word citta, which is a beautiful word. And what it means is something like the intelligent heart. Intelligent heart. And I love that phrase. It's also the title of a really lovely collection of images of Buddha rupas. And that subtitle, the intelligent heart, I really love that because it insists on the connection between head and heart. It insists on intellectual correlations to emotional experience. For what remains for my talk, I've got four questions that I'd like us to explore, and hopefully we'll get to the fourth. The four questions are as follows. Do we experience gratitude? And if so, what's it like? Second question, if we do experience gratitude, what are we grateful for? Third question, why feel gratitude? And then lastly, what do we do on the basis of experiencing gratitude if that is our experience? So first of all, do we experience gratitude? What is gratitude? What's meant by gratitude? Linguistically, its root is from the medieval Latin gratitudo. And earlier from that, earlier for a form of Latin, gratus, meaning pleasing or thankful. English dictionary definitions round on this quality of being thankful, a readiness to show appreciation for and to return kindness. It's come to us, importantly, through the work of the Roman philosopher Cicero, who was a key figure in the recovery and rediscovery of antiquity, of ancient Greek philosophy, and then again in our re-recovery of that in the Western Renaissance. And Cicero says, gratitude is not only the greatest of the virtues, but the parent of all the others. So this discussion of kindness and returning kindness it's important because it implies an awareness of and then a reciprocal recognition of what we have to be grateful for. Gratitude, I'd argue, is a robust and heroic quality. It's a fruit of practice and insight into spiritual experience. That is to say, it is not an emotion that's born of sentimentality. I think that's very important because if I can gesture more broadly to the culture for a moment, and there'll be lots of exceptions to this, but if I can gesture to that for a moment, what I've observed in many contexts is a real reluctance to experience gratitude and to express gratitude, even in environments where people are being given to hugely, whether that's, you know, in the context of the way that parent-child relationships are thought through, whether that's in the context of seeing how the benefits of wealth in an advanced wealthy country, how the benefits from the institutions we have flow to us. It strikes me that an expression of gratitude can be almost like kind of releasing ground, giving away ground for our, as it were, legitimate grievances. So if we do express gratitude, what are we grateful for? And when we do this, when we express gratitude, how precise, accurate, considered and appropriate are any of these expressions of gratitude? We have a practice in the Sangha called rejoicing in merit. Have many of us aware of that? Or have any of you done that at any one retreat on different... Can I just see that two hands? Great. Oh, fantastic. Okay, so I won't need to say too much about that. So you're in that wonderful position of having been introduced to this as a formal practice. It's not unusual, however, for people, even some who've taken this up as a practice, for people to feel awkward about both giving and receiving such rejoicings. So it would be good to investigate that a bit. As a culture, we can be very good at saying precisely where we think the other is wrong, in the wrong, and what their weaker qualities are. By contrast, we can lack a vocabulary of positivity, of an articulation of positive emotion. If you try complimenting people at work, or maybe even at home, and what you might find is an air of suspicion. I remember trying to find a more secular form of rejoicing in merit to encourage two colleagues in particular, and I am aware that in the... in the filmmaking world, I worked for many years in the documentaries unit of BBC TV and then Channel 4 and The Independent, and now more of my time is in university environments, which can be equally competitive in different ways. But I remember in one particular documentary unit wanting to appreciate the very fine work of two individuals and finding a sort of secular way to express that. And what struck me was, with one of them in particular, was an instant change of atmosphere, not to what one would hope you'd experience here, but an instant air of suspicion. There was a kind of, what does this guy want from me? To be saying something, you know, constructive about me and precise about the nature of that particular approach to filming and what was emerging from it. On the other side of it, it can be that suspicion. It can have two sides. It can have a sceptical, straight, cynical side. And then it can have another side, which would be, which would reveal a difficulty in receiving gratitude or even receiving praise. It can be a response perhaps not even articulated to oneself, but an emotional response of thinking, I'm not really worthy of this compliment. So our language reveals a lot about how we see the world, where and what is our lexicon for expressing gratitude, and if we enter a place without this quality, can we name that place? So I was thinking in one of these, you might describe it as an Ashra realm, a realm of titans, a titan realm, some of these sort of working environments. And I was thinking, oh, what's the word for a land or a place where gratitude can't be expressed, a place where it doesn't fully exist if it can't be articulated? I couldn't think of a word in English for that. Does anybody think of one? And I did a literature degree, I can't think of one. And I thought, well, that's really interesting that we don't have a word for a place where gratitude isn't expressed or is hard to express. I'd argue that a land without gratitude has elements of a hell realm, in that an absence of gratitude is an impoverished state. I've in my work, been frequently in environments where people are suffering, and either in the aftermath of conflict or sometimes in the run-up to it. And often these are in very poor parts of the world, and every time I come back here, I'm so struck by how fortunate we are with the welfare state. You know, we all have a medical card. Broadly speaking, we can seek and get medical treatment without worrying about the cost. Health has a higher value than the market. This is popularly acknowledged, but has not been with us for very long. It was only in Iron Bevan and the post-war Labour government that finally enabled the transition of that aspiration to become something lived by succeeding generations. And we know from public debate that the case for the value of this needs to be made repeatedly. Then more broadly, there's gratitude for our health. And I know that there are people in this room and many outside it who have challenges to their health. And sometimes it's hard to appreciate the value of health until it's threatened. Buddhism emphasizes this precious human opportunity to be born into a body that is a vehicle for our development, our spiritual development. This body too will pass away, but yet it's our vehicle now. So if we know this, what do we do on the basis of it? I've been through a period where my health has been increasingly under threat. Actually, I had a period of that this year. And coming through this, I can taste the preciousness of health and of being alive much more fully, perhaps more fully than I've known before. And that's a precious sort of emotion and glimpse and moment, because the gravitational pull, if you like, of experience is that, you know, before we know it, that the waters close above our head and we take all those things for granted. So when there's a glimpse of impermanence in that way, it's very valuable. The previous year, last year, I spent a lot of the time that I was filming last year, I spent with a young lady called Justine, who has what's called advanced neurological disorder, very severe disabilities. She can't speak, and so on. And by contrast, the reflection for me was more about, well, what do I do on the basis of this day of health? It's not a response of pity. That's very, very important. It's a response of reflecting on what do the gifts that we have mean for our future behaviour. Gentleman there said gratitude for the Buddha. Absolutely, gratitude for teachings, for the path. And I just want to draw out one teaching that I'm grateful for now, although in my early period of involvement here, I didn't really even see as a teaching and even sort of resented it, I think. And that's the first noble truth, the noble truth of dukkha. So the Buddha taught that the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. Yet he understood this, understood that a true experience of dukkha is what is needed by most people to be propelled onto the path. A friend of mine, I don't know where she didn't know where she got this quote from, but I like the phrase. She said, unlike plants, people grow fastest when they face darkness rather than light. It's not true of everyone, but it's a common experience that if you're suffering, and I'm making a distinction here, or assuming a distinction here, between being in pain and a dukkha. There's no virtue and there's no necessary development from just being in pain. It's unfortunate and we'll all go through it in different ways. But what the Dharma offers is a way of contextualizing and understanding pain as suffering, and suffering that's related to the marks of conditioned existence. And by following those truths through to the fourth noble truth, there is a path beyond suffering. So for some people, I've kind of shown my hand a bit by saying that I wasn't interested in the first noble truth. I sort of actively resisted it because I didn't really want it to be true. And that was partly because I was having quite a good time. Some good things were going sort of quite well for me. And so I didn't particularly want to be in a Buddhist centre where people say, no, actually, the truth is, the basic truth is suffering. I noticed that people who were progressing, as it were, more quickly than me were sometimes attracted to the idea of dukkha. And for people to whom dukkha correlates to the idea that life is painful or life doesn't work, that kind of worldview, they may well be initially more attracted to the First Noble Truth, as it can confirm the mental image of experiencing the world as painful. However, it's important, I think, to understand our tendencies, our characteristics of response. So if we've got a reflex that when someone says your life is painful, that we've got an instant, yes, that's how it is. It's important to keep an eye on this, because I had the opposite one, as I'm going to say something about later. But if you have an instant sense that that is true, it's good to check that out and understand, is that a response to the view that life is a, what as Bente describes, via negativa, which is basically a view that a pessimistic view of life. So if our cast of mind or even our character is more drawn to pessimism, that isn't necessarily an understanding of dukkha. It just so happens that there's a neat fit between some words that you've picked up from someone here and your own personal view that actually, you know, life's a bit rubbish, or my partner's just dumped me, or I've just been sacked, or I've just had this diagnosis, something like that. And something in the world is now reflecting the pain of that. What's important to get here is that the first noble truth is not an absolute truth. The fourth noble truth is evidence that the first is not an absolute truth. So dukkha, the first noble truth. Bhante Sangharakshita, among other teachers, unpacks this by saying that dukkha is methodology, not metaphysics. Dukkha is methodology, not metaphysics. And that's a very distilled way of saying that it's not that pain and suffering are the truth of things, it's that the Buddha discovered that exploring and seeing the nature of suffering is a way to advance spiritually, to be held in this case in the framework of the Four Noble Truths. So then the question becomes how to become open to dukkha, and this takes us right to Milarepa as well. We'll see from some quotes to come. But Bhante and the tradition offer very clear guidance about how to let in suffering and how to meet pain. And they're very simple injunctions and at times hard to practice. So in the face of this suffering, whatever stripe it comes in at the moment, we're invited not to blame the other, not to fall into self-pity, to avoid intoxicants, as the we began with the refuges and precepts, didn't we? Well, that's all encoded there. And then to build a positive stream of mental events. When going through difficulty, this may mean dwelling in pain, even in more severe pain than we have known before. But the insight, the learning that the gift of pain can give us is not achieved by bypassing this pain or distracting ourselves from it. So for people who are of the opposite disposition, a sunnier disposition, maybe more optimistic by cast of mind, and certainly I have a strong strain of that. This perception of dukkha may be off-putting or impenetrable or too threatening to really make sense of. It may be that our life is really quite pleasurable. And now, 5 years after coming here at the age of 30, I certainly felt this. I'd been in love, had relationships with the people that I'd really desired strongly. I had such a passion for my own vocation in writing and photography and making films. I was making films with some of the top documentary film camera people in the country. I was doing things that I deeply cared about. As a student, I was involved in various sort of progressive movements for social change, including anti-apartheid. I found myself in South Africa in 1994. The world's media was there expecting a bloodbath, and something quite extraordinary unfolded. I was working with Desmond Tutu, Mandela. I was doing things about real vision, if you like. I was in great health, had a lot of fun. I was doing things that were really meaningful to me. And yet, I remember at the end of that film, sort of in the summer of 1994, sending the film, putting them back on a plane from Johannesburg, and I decided to travel overland up to Zanzibar. My dad was born in Zanzibar, and I went on a kind of journey overland several thousand miles to see where Dad grew up. And on that journey, I remember feeling very strongly, this is great. I've kind of been given so much. And I've been able to do things that I feel, really appreciative of. But in the end, it didn't really taste. It didn't really... There's a sense of, there's got to be more to life than this. And I remember George Michael was very big at that time, and I remember one, I'm not going to sing it for you, don't worry. But I remember a line in one of his songs where it was something like... following dreams of heaven, but what the hell are you supposed to do when they come true? And I think there's a challenge to, as it were, success that we don't really talk about very much. It's kind of offered as, you should be chasing the nice, whatever it is, attractive partner, money, your nice car, whatever's on the advertising hoardings at the moment, happiness. And you get some of those things, and all of us have had tastes of different things that have given us some measure of happiness. Then what? And it was at that stage that I think I started to understand the first noble truth a bit better. That actually my life, however pretty in certain ways, and it wasn't all pretty, there was plenty of things that I struggled with on my journey to that age. Some very painful things, some very troubling things. But overall, there's a lot of fantastic things. But what I started to get a sense of is that the Buddha was teaching not that everything's suffering and everything's terrible, but that beauty, to the extent that I'd experienced it, in comparison to the higher beauty, that beauty was ugliness. Okay, I'm going to skip the next section because of time. Going to the next, the third question. Do we really feel gratitude, and how would we know if we do? How do we know whether we are experiencing a healthy gratitude? It's critical here to distinguish between gratitude that may result from sentimentality, fear, or other motives, such as submission to authority. And that submission to authority can happen in subtler ways within our own spiritual community, as well as the kind of more visible forms of authority in the world. Is that really gratitude that's come from insight, or is it deference? Because in some sense, for example, the power mode is at work. I was listening to the experiences of a married couple recently. One partner, and I know both parties in this situation, one partner had become so browbeaten that they were grateful for the slightest show of affection from the other, even when the bigger picture was that that person was being consistently undermined and even treated cruelly in the relationship. This was a kind of inappropriate gratitude resulting from an imbalance in a sexual relationship, and that person remained grateful for several years for even the slightest attention, and actually deserved very much better. So clarity about our own thoughts and emotions is foundational. In his book Know Your Mind, Sangharakshita offers a classic Dharmic methodology to understand our thoughts. Or what he calls our mental events, our thought processes. He makes an important distinction between devotion and faith, which may help us here, since a healthy and positive experience of gratitude can be a significant step towards developing faith. In fact, my experience is that gratitude is an essential element of faith, even if we haven't identified it and named it as such. Faith is expressed in gratitude, and the two mutually enforce each other. Sangharakshita offers a route to test out whether and what we have to be grateful for, and how to distinguish between devotion and faith. And I'm going to read a page from this wonderful book, Know Your Mind, by Bhante. So he says, devotion is an expression of faith in thoughts, words and deeds, and faith expresses itself in a sense of humility, gratitude and devotion towards one ideal. It is one thing to respect the Buddha as a great teacher, a great thinker, a great reformer, but it's quite another thing, quite a distinct mental event, in fact, to respect him as the enlightened one. Acknowledging the Buddha as the Buddha inevitably prompts one to act, not with a view to using the object of one's faith for one's own ends, but simply in order to devote oneself to it. Unfortunately, devotion is not always an expression of faith. In fact, it is very rarely this. Devotion in the sense of bhakti can be delightful and emotionally fulfilling. Decorating shrines can give one a great deal of aesthetic pleasure, but smiles and garlands do not add up to true devotion as an expression of faith. In other words, there are two levels of devotion, one antecedent to faith, antecedent to faith, the other the outcome of faith. The first level has its own value because it may lead to a genuine receptivity to the Dharma. But devotion as an expression of faith is quite distinct. It is more calm and more serious. I'm going to jump to the end of this bit of time. What Bhante is really helping us here with here, I think, is taking a scalpel to this distinction between devotion and faith, and really passing that, really inviting us to look not just at whether we have a pleasurable experience, whether we have a devotional response, but whether there's a deeper sense of what's carrying us through an experience, whether or not its tone is pleasurable or not. And the test is whether in the midst of a desert of suffering one stays faithful to one's practice. If one does, then one can be sure that it really is faith that sustains practice. Again, taking the example of Milarepa, when his teacher was making him build towers and knock them down again, he had faith even in the complete absence, at least for a while, of any pleasurable feeling at all. Milarepa, perhaps archetypally in the Buddhist tradition, is an expresser of gratitude. His gratitude and his faith are woven fine. So when we think about gratitude, what kind of response do we have? We need to look more closely at the texture of our emotional response. Milarepa repeatedly warns of the dangers of expecting gratitude or some return from his good deeds. So I'm jumping to this part because I think this is incredibly important. And before we leave tonight, I want us to try and identify something. Now that we've identified something we can be grateful for, I want us to invite us to think about what do we do, what action do we take on the basis of that insight into gratitude. But the mind is a slippery thing, and sometimes when we're working out how do I express gratitude or what do I do, it can be appropriated already by our mind thinking, oh, well, I'm going to get some nice experience out of this. Somebody will say to me, oh, thank you, or they'll feel good about me, or think I'm a nice person, or something like that. And one of the things that I love about Milarepa, and I don't know in the series whether you've been looking at this text, 100,000 Songs, there are many different iterations of the songs, there are different versions. There's one, the 60 Songs version is very useful as well if you want a more abbreviated way in, but I just wanted to show you that and tempt you to enter the Tiger's Cave with Milarepa and read you something of Milarepa. He's this wonder. I'm so drawn to the starkness of his asceticism and the rapture of his joyousness, and how the two is a very unusual combination and yet the most natural flowering of his practice. Here's one of a section from one of Milarepa's songs, and as you'll see, it relates to this idea of how the mind can appropriate gratitude. Harsh words and complaints requite goodwill and gratitude. Your sins hurt no one but yourself. Among 100 heads, you value most your own. In all 10 fingers, if one is cut, you feel the pain. Among all things you value, yourself is valued most. The time has come for you to help yourself. Life flees fast. Soon, death will knock upon your door. It is foolish, therefore, one's devotion to postpone. What else can loving kinsmen do but throw one into samsara? To strive for happiness hereafter is more important than to seek it now. The time has come for you to rely upon a guru. The time has come for you to practice dharma. I'll read the first line again. Harsh words and complaints requite goodwill and gratitude. Harsh words and complaints requite goodwill and gratitude. So if we're going to follow this invitation to a land where gratitude is more freely expressed and you are part of its expression, Milarepa is very clear. Harsh words and complaints requite goodwill and gratitude. Requite meaning are a response to, are a repayment for. So if we go into wanting to explore and ideally embody the expression of gratitude, it's inappropriate, shall we say, to go into that trying to get something back from it. If something comes back, that's a fantastic bonus. But it's not really gratitude if we go into it thinking, what would we get back in return? So to end with Milarepa. Milarepa was, as you know, an advanced yogi. He influenced and reputation hard won. And as he became more and more revered and famous, people would come to his cave, including his sister at one point, and say, come on, Milarepa, you don't have to meditate all the time. Can you come and teach us some more? Or come and hang out in the town, do this, do that. And they used very persuasive arguments on the face of it. They said, look, you're a really advanced practitioner. You don't need to meditate. You're already really realised. Help us unenlightened people. But Milarepa stayed true to his practice, saying this, through the practice of meditation, I show gratitude to my guru. Pray, grant me your grace, ripen and liberate me. So his form of expressing gratitude to his guru was to continue in meditation. And we each need to find an appropriate language. I use the word language metaphorically. It can be words, as a couple of people have said, already this evening, but it may be you want to express gratitude to someone who may not be able to receive it, or would find it difficult, or wouldn't be able to make sense of it. So it may be that you can do something for them, some action that would help them. The point to draw out here is that we too need to find appropriate ways to express our gratitude in a language that makes sense to us and hopefully to the recipient, and to do this now. To do this without expectation of any return. The fruit of this activity is the yogi's joy. And I'd like to end with another refrain from Milarepa. I am happy with the hard cushion beneath me. I am happy with the cotton cloth which covers me. I am happy with the cord of meditation which ties my knees. I am happy with this phantom body, neither starved nor satiated. I am happy with this mind, which has gained insight into reality. I am not unhappy. I am happy.